Welcome, everybody. Welcome to this IDEAS LSE International History Department lecture. Welcome to the LSE if you're from outside the LSE. It's a great pleasure and privilege to introduce my colleague, Dr. Piers Ludlow, who is our speaker tonight. He's a leading historian of the EEC, the EU, as I'm sure many of you know. And in the course of his academic career, he's written extensively on all aspects of the EEC, EU, and on Britain's place in that. He's the author of three books. His first book started at the beginning, Least for Britain. It was dealing with Britain, the sixth and the first UK membership application. His second book, move further into the 1960s, European Community in the Crisis of the 1960s, Negotiating the Gaullist Challenge. His third book, about which he's talking today, is Roy Jenkins and the European Commission Presidency, 1976 to 1980, at the heart of Europe. But actually, simply listing the three books doesn't really give justice at all to Piers's contribution to the scholarly debate on the EU, because he's been the editor and joint editor of many works with European colleagues on history of the EU, and of numerous articles and chapters on the subject. So I think he really is our man on the EU. He's going to... let me first say, sorry, the Twitter hashtag, the hashtag is at LSE Jenkins, not LSE Ludlow. That's important. But tonight, Piers is going to talk about, I think, some time that many of us might think was a happier time, but at least a different time, and that the title of the lecture is A Britain at the Heart of Europe, Revisiting Roy Jenkins' Presidency of the European Commission.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you, Janet, for that introduction. It's always exciting and a sort of rite of passage to launch a book, even though it feels a little bit fake, because the book actually has been out for a little while, but it came out at the sort of time of year where a launch event would have fallen totally flat, so I wanted to wait until a moment when enough people could be gathered together. What I want to try and do today is tell you a little bit about what type of book this is, because it's a somewhat different enterprise from previous things that I've written. I then want to explain a little bit about how the book came to be, because I think that is both interesting but also perhaps revealing of the way in which a contemporary historian can work, although not necessarily should work. And then I want to highlight some of the main conclusions of the book. I'm not going to say very much in my sort of talk about Brexit. This was a pre-Brexit book. But inevitably, one's perspective on the whole Britain and Europe issue has been changed by recent events, and I'm very happy to delve into those murky waters in questions. But this is going to be a kind of pre-Brexit talk, although it might be a Brexit-influenced question session. So let me start by saying a little bit about the nature of the book. This is very much a close-up study of one job, one man, and one narrow period of European history. I've written previous things that were, perhaps to use a photographic metaphor, used the wide-angle lens to try and appreciate the multiplicity of viewpoints that go into making to European policy making and trying to explain and explore the collision of national interests and supranational interests that takes place in Brussels. That was my methodology in the first two books that Janet has just mentioned, and that was something I remain committed to as an important way of studying what goes on in Brussels. But this time I decided, for reasons that I'll explain in a little bit, to try and do something different. This time round I decided that I wanted to zoom in on one particular role within the community system, namely that of the Commission President, and one particular individual to have filled that role, namely Roy Jenkins. As such, it's a study of a job, both the strengths and the powers of that job, but also, I suspect, more tellingly and more importantly, the limitations and the deficiencies of that job. But it's also a study of a man, Jenkins was an individual who mattered in British politics, who was somebody I'd come across a lot before, but this was a real opportunity to look in detail at an important moment in his life story, and to study the way in which he fitted into a very different environment for 4 years. And again, I think the story that comes out of that is a mixture of success and failure. In many respects, he adapted remarkably well to Brussels, and yet there too there were problems, there were limitations, and some of his failings as a politician, to a certain extent even as a man, were apparent in those years in Brussels. But it's also, I think, a way of studying a period. I'm not going to claim that the book revolutionises our approach to the 1970s or understanding of the period. I think to do so would be ridiculous. But I do think that studying a period through the lens of one man's preoccupations, looking at many of the key issues of the day as they presented themselves to the President of the Commission, and as he discussed them with his multiple interlocutors elsewhere in the European community, gives us an interesting insight, is one way into the 1970s, and particularly the late 1970s, which are still a period that international historians are grappling to come to terms with. We know a lot more about the period, I think, than we did 10 years ago, but it's still very much at the sort of the coal face of current scholarship. And so that aspect too appealed to me about the book and helps explain why I wrote it. The actual genesis of the book, though, was a very particular one, and it's perhaps worth recounting that with you, so going through that, because it is a bizarre story, but also one I think that is perhaps interesting and reveals a little bit about the nature of the study. I didn't set out intending to write a book about Jenkins. The origins of this project lie in the acceptance of something I'm rather too bad at saying no to, or fond of saying yes to, namely an invitation to join a collaborative project designed to put together a large volume of history on the European Commission between 1973, which was of course the year the British joined, and 1986. This project was the second in the second volume of an official history of the Commission. It was, as such, financed and partly organised by the European Commission itself, which involved, and that's another story, all sorts of delicate bargaining and compromises between the historians and the institution. But as part of that project, I therefore found myself encouraged to do a great deal of interviewing. Now, I'm a contemporary historian, and as such, I am somebody who has had the opportunity before to talk and interview people who have lived through the periods that I'm working on and to pose direct questions to them. But I was, and to a certain extent, I remain a little bit of a sceptic about oral history, at least as far as political history is concerned. I was more struck in the interviews that I had previously conducted by the gaps in people's memory and by the way in which the past had been reinvented than I was struck by the sort of the tellingness and the import of what they did remember. So I was a little bit reluctant, but the Commission History Project was very much going to be a oral history-driven project, and as such I was asked to interview a large number of former Commission officials. Now, the way that the team was organised meant that the key criteria for determining who one interviewed was geographical and to a certain extent linguistic. And so as the only English-based member of the consortium doing this collective project, I ended up talking to a lot of Brits and a lot of people, therefore, who, it turned out, had served with Jenkins in Brussels. And in the process, I therefore found myself talking to a large number of those who had shared those 4 years in Brussels with Jenkins. Jenkins himself, of course, was dead, and so I couldn't speak to him, but I did speak to the head of his private office. I spoke to the deputy head of the private office. I spoke to several others who'd served very closely with him. I spoke to two of his former fellow commissioners and a variety of other senior officials who'd had a lot of interaction with him. So I did feel that that process brought me up quite close to the Jenkins presidency in a way I hadn't fully anticipated. But the real breakthrough came not with the oral history interviews, or not directly from the oral history interviews, because, as I said, I remain slightly doubtful as to whether one can really write detailed political history primarily from an oral history source. The real breakthrough came at the end of one of these interviews. When I went to interview Sir Crispin Tickell, who was chef de cabinet, so in other words, the head of Jenkins' private office in Brussels, I asked, as I always did at the end of the interview, and we had, in addition to my spontaneous questions, we had a kind of set questionnaire that we had to go through. Right at the end of the interview, I asked the standard question, which had never before elicited much of an interesting response: do you have any private papers that might be of interest? To which the response was, yes, 27 boxes of the stuff in All Souls College, Oxford. And it turned out that the Brussels, and I knew this already, but I hadn't quite thought through the full implications, the European Commission has a very strange attitude towards private papers, or at least to official papers. Namely, it regards the papers of the private office of a European Commissioner, or at least it did regard, I think the rules have changed since, but anyway, in the period that I am talking about, it regarded the private papers of a European Commissioner as his, or potentially her, although there were no female commissioners in this era, private property. And so as Tickell left Brussels, bound for Old Souls, where he was to take up a visiting fellowship, in waiting for his next diplomatic post to turn up, he was handed 27 boxes worth of papers from his office. And as he was going to All Souls, he took them to All Souls and he left them in the cellar there, untouched for 30 years, until I asked the question. Now that suddenly, and Tickell was then very kind enough to phone All Souls and arrange for me to see them, and I was given access to this. Now this turned out, this totally transformed the nature of the project, because I suddenly had access to a really detailed source of primary materials on the Commission presidency of Roy Jenkins. What's more, this represented in the Brussels world a huge exception, because the European Commission is a strange institution, but one of the things that on the whole it is not terribly good at is keeping records. I've spent quite a lot of time in previous projects delving through the records of the European Commission, and I think it would be fair to say that the politest term I could use would be about them is patchy, and that is being quite polite. There are huge gaps. There are a lot of things that are recorded in only very skeletal detail. The minutes, for instance, of the weekly meetings of the European Commission, so where the however many commissioners come together to discuss the problems of the day, are terse in the extreme. They are a little better than a record of decisions taken, but there's not really much sense of how decisions were arrived at, etc. So writing a detailed history from such a record base has always been a source of frustration, and I had written about quite extensively about the Commission before, and I knew this. The Tickell collection was something utterly different. The Tickell collection was the product of a moment when a group of Whitehall-trained civil servants found themselves transported to Brussels to serve a politician who also had a Whitehall background or a Westminster background, and therefore expected this level, the Westminster level of service. And so in this collection were detailed records of virtually all the meetings that Jenkins had with interlocutors in each of the European countries and beyond. There were detailed preparations for key decisions. There were detailed minute trails about how decisions were taken. There were detailed detailed accounts of major trips and major negotiations, etc. It was an utterly different collection of papers from anything that I had seen before. And it therefore meant that I had the makings of something utterly different from the rather sort of frustratingly vague writings about the European Commission that had generally been produced before. On top of this, I then got a second stroke of luck in that I tried to use, and I successfully used, the access that the Commission History Project gave me to write to Jenkins' widow, Lady Jenkins, to ask for permission to look at the unpublished manuscript of the European Diary. Jenkins, as some of you may know, is unique amongst Commission presidents in having written, kept a diary while in office, and he published a version of this diary in the early 1980s. Shortly after he ceased to be president. But in the foreword to that published version, there is a very clear explanation that a substantial amount of editing has been done, and the particularly large number of references to the internal workings of the European Commission have been removed, because Jenkins felt that these were the least interesting things for his readership, which may well have been an accurate judgment. But of course, from my point of view, those are precisely the things I wanted most, and therefore it was crucial important for me to see the unedited, uncut version, which I suspected was amongst his private papers in his house at East Hendred. Well, half of it was, or at least I think both halves were, but I only succeeded in finding half in the few hours that I had to root around his attic. But I photographed half, and then I intercepted the second half in the Bodleian Library 2 years later, by which time it had been transferred there along with the rest of his papers. But the unedited diary and this Tickell collection gave me an absolutely fundamentally different source base from any other writing that I'd done on the European Commission, and I think enabled me to get close to both the job and the man in a way that was somewhat exceptional. So, what does all this enable me to do? Well, let me highlight a few of the key conclusions of the book. I can go into more detail about any of the key episodes later if you so wish, but let me just sort of fast forward in a sense to the key conclusions. And they are conclusions that are split up a bit like the optics I described at the beginning of the talk. They're split into conclusions about the nature of the job, conclusions about Jenkins the man and his interaction with the job, and conclusions about the state of the European community and Europe more generally at the end of the in the late 1970s and into 1980. So, conclusions, the nature of the job. I think the first thing that came across very clearly from these papers was the extent to which the European Commission president, particularly if the post is held by somebody of Jenkins' stature and intellectual calibre, does give means to hold extensive, substantive, largely friendly, but also quite hard-hitting discussions with all of the key decision-makers around Europe. These detailed accounts of the meetings that Jenkins held catalogued the way in which he was able to talk in depth, very frankly, very openly, very forcefully with Giscard d'Estaing, the French president of the time, Helmut Schmidt, the German chancellor, Jim Callaghan and then Margaret Thatcher, the British prime ministers, but also Jimmy Carter, the US president, the Japanese prime minister, the Indian prime minister, Indira Gandhi, etc., etc., etc. So there was a fascinating series of pretty hard-hitting discussions, which I think do show the importance of bilateral access that the president gains. Also clear was the importance of multilateral access. Jenkins was one of the first Commission presidents to be able to play upon the two summit tables which the Commission president gains access to. The first was one that, in a sense, was already a fait accompli. It was already something that his predecessor had been entitled to, and which he didn't have to fight too hard to gain, although I think he played an important role in consolidating, which was access to the European Council. The European Council, which is the gathering of European leaders, was at this stage a very new institution. It's created at the end of 1974, meets for the first time in 1975. But it had been decided the Commission President would attend as of right, so therefore from 1977 onwards, Jenkins attends all of the European Council meetings. And there too, I think he was able to show what a Commission President can do in that company. A Commission President can't match a German Chancellor or a French President or a British Prime Minister or even some of the smaller state leaders in terms of political clout. He doesn't have the democratic mandate, he doesn't have the authority that comes from the job. But what a good Commission President can do, and I think Jenkins began to show what was possible, although Delors would later perfect these techniques and take them to a totally different level, was play upon the fact that he has a huge body of expertise and a knowledge of how the intricacies of the European integration process work that is over and above that of most of his counterparts. And I think Jenkins' operation at European Council level, particularly in his role in the birth of the European monetary system, but also to a certain extent in his role over the pushing forward the process of enlargement, especially to Greece, that was of crucial importance. The other summit that Jenkins had to fight very hard to gain access to, but which again, I think, highlights the potential of the role, and again, this was a new summit that had just been created, were the newly devised meetings of the G7. Now, getting access to the G7 proved to be the first big battle, the first big tussle of the Jenkins presidency. He was not there as of right, but instead he had to protest loudly and vociferously to be allowed in. He was not without supporters. The smaller states of the European community, the countries that didn't participate in the G7, were very anxious to see the Commission President involved, not least because they realised that the G7 discussed a lot of things that fell within community competence and as such directly involved them, but where they weren't represented. He had strong support also from the Italians, who were present at the G7, although it wasn't always as forcefully expressed as it might have been. And he had fleeting and somewhat ambivalent support from Helmut Schmidt, who in the end actually was crucial in getting him in, but was never entirely certain about how hard he wanted to push. But he had to gain access more or less over the dead bodies of Callaghan and Giscard d'Estaing, both of whom were determined that he should not get in. And therefore, the first 6 months of the Commission presidency is spent very much battling to get in. But once he was in, again, the importance of having a high-calibre president who is able to contribute substantively to the discussions, I think, comes out very clearly. Of course, he is not at the same level as the seven key participants. And yet, because intellectually he was, because he knew the subject matter, because he could speak with authority on matters economic and on some of the key political issues of the day, Jenkins was able to participate in the summits to which he was belatedly allowed, with, I think, a strong degree of effectiveness and importance. And I think in the process, he therefore consolidated this presence. In a sense, having fought so hard, had he been a wimp, or had he been a figure like his successor, Gaston Thorn, who was much less substantial, the access once granted might easily have been denied. But because Jenkins was able to, in a sense, use the access he'd been given to do something important, do something substantive, I think that his presence, his right to be at the top table, was acknowledged and therefore survived up until today. Although, of course, the G7 has mutated in many different forms. So I think access is very, very important. That can make it sound as if the job is an extremely powerful one. You could also get that impression from the way in which Jenkins was able to push forward a number of key priorities and to gain at least partial advance to some of the objectives he outlined. The most striking successes of his period in power were the launch of the European monetary system, the fast-forwarding of Greek enlargement, And the resolution, albeit temporary, of the British budgetary question. And in all of those, Jenkins played an important role. But I think in each of them, we need to look a little bit more carefully at the nature of the role, because it's a slightly peculiar one. So, for instance, on the EMS, his role was fundamentally that of an initiator, but not somebody who could carry it through. He puts forward the idea, not a particularly original idea, an idea that was already doing the rounds, but at least he kind of revitalises the idea by making a number of public speeches on the issue and bringing it up at European Council level. But the EMS would not have come into being had not two much more powerful politicians in the form of Giscard d'Estaing and Helmut Schmidt picked up the ball and run with it. And so, as I say in the conclusions, Jenkins was in a sense forced to, but actually I think his personality allowed him to be content with the role of the scrum half who passes it to the more powerful runners rather than trying to get to the try line himself. He wouldn't have had the political clout to do so. Likewise, enlargement was something he could help but couldn't deliver. Greece would not have joined just because the Commission President was on its side. It was a useful advantage, it was perhaps almost a necessary advantage, but it certainly wasn't a sufficient advantage. And again, it was crucial that he got support and got agreement from some of the key member states, particularly the German presidency. And enlargement, too, shows the limitations of the role, because whereas he was able to push forward Greek enlargement, once the French decided that Spanish and Portuguese posed too much of a challenge, particularly the Spanish, to French farmers, and as such would be an electoral liability and that they should therefore go slow on the process, Jenkins was powerless to resist. He wanted very much Spain and Portugal to enter in about 1982-1983, but when the French jammed the brakes on, he could encourage the Spanish, and he travelled to Madrid and to Lisbon, and he sort of patted them on the backs and said, there, etc. But fundamentally, he could do nothing to change the outcome. And until the French decided that they would lift the roadblock, nothing more could be done. So it's an example of both power enlargement, but also the limits of that power. And also, I think in the case of the British budgetary question, it shows how much a Commission President could do, and I think he played an important contribution in the temporary solution reached in June 1980. But it's a limited achievement, and he wasn't really able to address the fundamental imbalances that lay at the heart of the British budgetary issue, with the result that the issue would come back to haunt the Tory presidency and indeed dominate the politics of the European community in the first half of the 1980s. So for all of the successes, or even the successes, highlight, I think, the limitations of the role and the limits of the Commission power. And alongside these successes, I think there are a catalogue of even clearer failures. Jenkins put forward a lot of policy proposals, a lot of policy ideas that went nowhere. This is true over CAP reform, this is true over commission reform, this is true over the fundamental reform of the whole budgetary system, this is true over energy policy. There were a whole number of issues and areas where one could say this is something where the Commission President had good ideas, but nothing happened. It's even the case that some of the key issues that one associates with the relance of the mid-1980s, the surge forward of the European integration project under Jacques Delors in the mid-1980s, the idea for a single market is doing the rounds in Brussels in the 1970s. Jenkins is trying to sell this to his interlocutors too, and yet without member state support, without the consensus among the member states that this is the direction they wanted to go forward, no amount of silver-tongued advocacy by a Commission President can help move this forward, and therefore the dossier advanced not one jot while he was there. So I think the limitations of the role come through even more clearly than do its powers. Couple of brief further thoughts about the role. One of the other things that comes across is simply how little of the Commission activity a Commission President is on top of. I was very struck, because I was doing these two projects at the same time, one my own kind of presidential eye view on Jenkins and the other this broad overview of the Commission activity, quite how many things I knew the Commission was up to that were controversial, important, delicate, etc. during this era that Jenkins was just not interested in. Of course he knew about them. Of course course, he sometimes had to deal with them. He would chair meetings where they were discussed, etc. And yet, fundamentally, they didn't impinge upon his universe. So, for instance, the whole area of Étienne d'Avignon's interventionism within the European steel industry, which is a big story in these years, that just passes him by almost entirely without a mention. The other thing that came across very strongly was the dangers of appointing a heavyweight politician like Jenkins to this job. He was appointed because he was a heavyweight. Schmidt and Giscard, in particular, wanted a commission president who could mix it with the top table, with the key decision makers. They wanted somebody who could contribute to the European Council level, and Jenkins provided that. But the problem about going for a big politician, particularly from a big member state, is that the job isn't powerful enough if prospects seem to open up once more at home. Jenkins accepts the post in 1976 because his British career seems to be over. When he fails in the leadership campaign to succeed Wilson and is beaten by Callaghan, that seems to be game over as far as British politics are concerned, and therefore he takes the Brussels job. But as soon as the 1979 election happens and Jenkins can see possibilities opening up once more in British politics, particularly in the centre ground, now vacated by a Labour Party that is seemingly heading to the left and a Conservative Party heading to the right. Sorry, eerily familiar, but I won't go there. He sees opportunities that come increasingly to distract his time in Brussels. It's not to say that he's kind of in dereliction of his job in the final years and months in Brussels. I think he continues to be quite an effective president. But it's totally clear from the May 1979 onwards that the prospects of a second term have gone, and therefore the prospects of really making a fundamental mark on the system are fading. He will do his job, he will do it reasonably effectively, but the energy and the dynamism that have marked some of the early interventions do ebb away. So much about the job. Briefly, and very briefly, because I realise I don't want to talk for too much longer, a few reflections about the man, and then a little bit about the system in the 1970s. Jenkins, the man, it's funny, I went into this process liking Jenkins, and I come out of it still liking Jenkins. I think he is a flawed individual. And he certainly had a number of weaknesses as a commission president that were due to his personality, but there are actually weaknesses that I had some sympathy for and could relate to. I enjoyed, in a sense, getting up close to him, particularly through the pages of his detailed diary. What were these weaknesses? Well, I think the weaknesses are particularly his difficulty in interacting with his subordinates. He was very good with those he knew well. He had exceptionally close relations with his cabinet, and all of the members of the cabinet with whom I spoke are enormously loyal and appreciative of his behaviour. But it's quite clear that he didn't succeed in making very firm links with many others in the European Commission, and in particular, he was rather prone, although his French improved, to live in a rather anglophone universe populated largely by visitors from England, much less by those who were Brussels-based. So in some ways he doesn't succeed in plugging himself into very well, and I don't think he really relates at all to the Commission staff more generally. He doesn't have a kind of populist touch. This is true when he was an MP. David Auckland, who was one of the people I spoke to, said one of the reasons he loses out in the Labour Party is that he was lousy at going to the House of Commons bar and just having a drink with a Labour backbencher. He was fantastic over a good bottle of claret at a fancy dinner party, but he was very bad at the kind of day-to-day interactions of which much politics is made. And so I think that weakness comes across loud and clear, as does his continuing interest, obsession and fascination with British politics, which, as I explained, ultimately undermined some of his final time in Brussels. And yet there are also clear strengths. He does adapt remarkably well. His French does improve. He does adapt to the different way that politics is done in Brussels very fast. And I think showed the fact that as a British politician, he had really quite an open mind about how politics could be done and was prepared to accept that at a European level things operated very differently. He made some changes, some of them enduring changes, particularly, for instance, the habit of Commissioner Way days or a meeting before the commission, before a new commission takes place, both of which have survived and have been copied by his successors. But he was prepared to play in this very different system, and I think play relatively well. So I think it is an interesting period in his life story, but it does fundamentally show his passion was a passion for centrist politics and for Britain being part of Europe, perhaps more than a passion for the intricacies of Europe itself. I'm struck by the way in which, except possibly for the moment of the European monetary system and enlargement, his fascination is in a sense almost more with what this system could do for Britain and how this could be made more congenial to Britain rather than adapting the system for everybody else. And that is perhaps revealing again about the dangers of putting a big national politician in this role. Finally, a couple of brief thoughts about the era. I think this vantage point allows you to pinpoint, to say a number of quite interesting things about the 1970s as a moment in the European integration process. It's a moment of evident crisis, it's a moment of difficulty, it's a moment of frustration. A lot of Jenkins' failures have little to do with Jenkins as a man, and much to do with the state that the community finds itself in during this era. But it also is a period where, in a sense, the ingredients necessary for a relaunch of Europe are by and large assembled, with one crucial or two crucial exceptions. Already the institutions are basically there that were needed. By the time you move towards a directly elected European Parliament in 1979, you have a working European Council, you have a directly elected European Parliament, you have a relatively effective European Commission, albeit one with low morale, and you have a Council of Ministers that is at last beginning to be reformed and is ceasing to be a roadblock. The institutional system, therefore, could move forward. You also have the beginnings of an agenda. The ideas of the single market, the idea of concentrating on monetary integration, the consequences of pushing through with enlargement, all of those things are already there. And again, they would be crucial to the advances of the late 1980s. But what is lacking, and crucially lacking, is a series of member state decisions in favour. And it strikes me that the member states in the era are caught at two levels. They're caught because they don't yet know what sort of Europe they want. There is still a fundamental uncertainty in the leading European powers, and I think this is an uncertainty that includes Jenkins, about whether the Europe that should be built should be a liberalising Europe, a single market Europe, a Europe of deregulation, or whether it instead should be an interventionist Europe, a dirigiste Europe, a Europe which basically builds an industrial counterpart to the CAP and tries to deal with the problems of European industry by direct intervention. That philosophical political dilemma has yet to be resolved in Jenkins' time, and I think Jenkins too was conflicted on this fundamental issue. Second fundamental uncertainty was an uncertainty as to whether Europe itself was the appropriate scale for the crisis to be fought. It was clear that the crisis of the 1970s needed a response, and needed a response that went beyond the individual actions of member states. But there was a profound uncertainty as to whether the best level at which to combat the crisis was the new global level of G7 summitry, or whether it was instead the regional level of the European Community mechanisms. And I think throughout the whole of Jenkins' time in Brussels, that fundamental dilemma too had not been resolved. And until those dilemmas are resolved, in favour of the kind of liberal agenda and in favour of the regional agenda rather than the global agenda, no Commission President would have been able to push the process further forward. And so in a way I do think the Jenkins era casts an important light forward to what would subsequently happen during the period where Delors was in charge. Delors was very much the right man in the right place at the right time. Jenkins was perhaps the right man, but it wasn't quite clear that he was in the right place, and he certainly was there at the wrong time. Thank you.
Many thanks, Piers. I think I've grown to like Jenkins myself, actually, during your talk, even with all the limitations and the frustrations that you've outlined. We do have some time for questions. You've got about 45 minutes, so welcome questions from the floor. If you could identify yourself, I think that would help, and I'll probably take questions maybe two or three at a time. Have you got a pen with you?
Yeah, I have.
Okay, you have some questions? All right, we'll start right at the back. We'll have one there, and we'll have one there right at the back as well. We'll take those two questions first.
Good evening. My name is Lorenzo. Thank you very much for your presentation. I enjoyed it very much. You mentioned Greece and also Jenkins' participation in helping to bring Greece into the EU. My understanding is that by the big players, it was sort of understood that Greece was cooking the books, as we call it in America, in order to bring them into the system. And I'm wondering if he brought up that in any of his diaries and what he thought about Greece overall.
Okay, we'll have a second question as well, please.
Right, hi, Matthias Heusler. Thanks very much for your talk. You mentioned one of the main things was a bilateral dimension, and of course the biggie there is Britain, right? And I was wondering how much his kind of background as a high-profile politician coming from Britain kind of influenced his role in the Anglo-EC relationship. Was there a sense of conflicting loyalties falling between stools, so on? And the two things I'm thinking about, of course, are one, the European monetary system, where the Germans are quite fed up that he doesn't push Callaghan more strongly on it, where there's a personal dynamic as well. And then the budgetary question, where he's instrumental in coming up with a solution, but it's also, as you said, a very temporary solution. So how do these kind of conflicting loyalties play out?
We'll take those
two. Okay. On Greece, the cooking the books thing is much more about Greece's entry into the euro, which of course happens much, much later on in the game rather than at this stage. I think his approach to the Greek issue was a fundamentally political approach. I think there was a recognition, how could there not be, that European Community membership would be a major challenge for Greece, and in a way would also be a challenge for the community. Greece was a country with major problems, and therefore adaptation to the European Community system was not going to be easy, and that was an adaptation that would involve both adaptation in Athens and in Greece, and also adaptation at the Brussels level. And I don't think he was in any way closing his eyes to that problem. But I think what he regarded as the fundamental political reason for admitting Greece was a political decision. He strongly believed that Mediterranean enlargement, so expansion not just simply to Greece but also to Spain and Portugal, had to be delivered because these were countries that had recently emerged from periods of authoritarian rule. They were countries to which encouragement had been given and promises made by a generation of European leaders, and Europe had to come good on those promises. There was no way in which Europe could, in a sense, shun Greece, Spain, or Portugal without seriously endangering the survival of democracy in those countries. And so I think he felt that political imperative overrode any hesitations and misgivings you might have about the weaknesses of the Greek economy or the potential for problems between Greece and Turkey that Greek accession might prove, etc. So there were loads of problems, and I think he was aware of those problems, but I think he made, in my view, a correct call that this were a series of political problems, political imperatives that overrode those and needed to override those, and hesitation wasn't really a permissible option. Matthias, thanks for the question, an excellent one. He was, I think, throughout a very British president. Although that didn't, I think, play out in terms of Anglo-community relations in the way that he anticipated. I think Jenkins' hope was, when he took up the role, that the presence in Brussels of a heavyweight British politician would enable the system to be, in a sense, demystified for his countrymen. that they would begin to see European integration as something to which they were committed, in which they participated, and which could bring benefits to their country in a way that hadn't previously been the case, because it was still regarded as an other people's show run by the French and Germans, etc., and done in a fashion that the British weren't comfortable with. And I think he very much hoped he would be able to change that dynamic, and that is one of the big failures of his time in Brussels, that he does not achieve that. In many ways, the deterioration, so in many ways, Anglo-EC relations are worse in 1981 when he leaves office than they had been in 1977 when he arrived. Now, I don't think that's his fault. I think it has much more to do with the policies of the Callaghan government, and particularly the policies of the early Thatcher government. But it nevertheless was one of the major disappointments of his time in Brussels. And I think one of the many reasons why he decides to go back to British politics is I think he feels that he can serve the cause of British Europeanism better as a figure in the domestic sort of rough and tumble on the issue than he can by being Britain's man in Brussels, as it were. His interaction with his British counterparts is fascinating. With Callaghan, it was a strangely tense relationship. The two were, of course, people who had known each other for many years, but they'd always been rivals and always had a somewhat uncomfortable relationship with one another. And yet, surprisingly, there were moments of kind of almost intimacy. You would know this as well as I do, but the Bremen Council was one such. The Bremen Council was a European Council meeting in 1978 when the Franco-German ideas about the European monetary system, so the process that Jenkins had started, but this is the Franco-German sort of picking up of the ball, is made public to the other European leaders. And this comes as a real shock and a kind of almost kicking the solar plexus to Callaghan. And what's fascinating is Jenkins is very enthusiastic about Schmidt and Giscard having picked up the ball as he's passed them. He's committed to the project. He really wants it to happen. And so, in a sense, he's on the opposite side of the argument from Callaghan, who is already very, very ambivalent about the process. And yet, after the council meeting, the discussion is after dinner, so it's already pretty late at night when the formal session ends. Callaghan says, "Come back to my hotel room," and there's a kind of impromptu dialogue with the Commission president that takes place at some god-awful time in the small hours of the morning, where Jenkins is trying to explain to Callaghan what this potentially could mean, why this was not necessarily terrible news for Britain, but also trying to advise him on how to play a part in this Franco-German dialogue on the issue. And so in a bizarre sort of way, Jenkins is both kind of the enemy as one of the progenitors of this project, but also he's there acting as an advisor and a friend and a sort of almost shoulder to cry on. I don't think it quite gets to that point, but there is a very bizarre dynamic, and you get similar instances later on. Ditto the relationship over the budget. I think Jenkins himself and Tugendhat, who was the budgetary commissioner, both feel that their nationality is a major problem when they have to stand up and talk about the BBQ, the British budgetary question, or the bloody British question, as it continues to be, abbreviated in Brussels. But actually, I think the fact that they had a kind of foot in both camps was very, very important. If you look at the substance of the Commission mediation and the way in which they managed to come up with a temporary truce, this reflects the fact that they are having intensely close dialogue with Whitehall. And a large number of those senior civil servants who are in Jenkins' cabinet, but of course were former Foreign Office or Treasury officials, are being leaked all sorts of things from their counterparts in Whitehall and vice versa. So there is an extraordinary intimacy of exchange which would not have happened had the Commission President been a Dane or a Belgian or a Frenchman or whatever, which I think does help facilitate the conclusion. And yet, does Thatcher give him any credit for this? So it's an interesting one.
Got one question down here. One. Okay, we'll have a lady at the back there, and you, sir, and then you as a third one.
Hi, my name's Lindsay Ackwee. Thanks for a great talk, Piers. My question kind of follows on this idea of having a British European Commission president. I wonder how far were sort of British how far was British political culture and British administrative traditions already embedded in the European Commission before Jenkins came to Brussels? And how much did having a British European Commission president move that process along?
Okay, and then the second question is down here.
Hussein Casimir, I really enjoyed your talk and I look forward to reading the book. I've got three questions.
That's cheating.
Yeah, the first question is about the institutionalisation of the office, because other people who've written about Jenkins talk about, there's that famous quote from Campbell, you know, it's not scarcely an office at all, no office at all. So I wondered how he made the office, what he thought about the office before he assumed it, and whether he was an institutional builder in that sense. The second question is about the impact on him and his coterie, and it follows on from the first question, really. And there were a lot of misconceptions that Brits had on before going to Brussels, and I wondered how many of those were altered by the experience on the part for Jenkins, but also for people like Tickell and the others in sort of coterie who hadn't worked in Brussels before. And the third thing is just, did you use the Noel papers at all? And I'd be interested to know what his relationship was with Noel.
Okay.
Would you take one more question? Yes, Rebecca, please.
Yes, Simon Strickland. Thanks very much for your talk. You said at the end that Jenkins was, to a degree, torn between operating at the regional level or the global level. Surely at the time he was president of the Commission, there weren't really any other kind of regional community organisations around the world to go on, so that he would have been effectively thinking in a rather pioneering way what might, if you like, speculatively work at regional level that wasn't already functional through the European setup. So is there any insight in his private papers as to his thinking on that?
Okay, well, thanks for those. Again, excellent questions. The British administrative tradition. Well, there was, of course, a cohort of Brits who had already arrived. Jenkins arrived in 1977, the first Brits to arrive in Brussels that arrived in 1973. But, of course, they were joining an institution that already existed, that already had a series of patterns of work and habits and so on. And I think one of the frustrations that many British bureaucrats of the first generation felt was that the adaptation was largely a one-way street. They adapted to the way Brussels did things rather than Brussels adapting to the way that they did things. Over time, I think the British administrative tradition did manage to change a little bit. It's always difficult in these things to disentangle what was going to happen anyway because of the changing era, changing technologies, changing management ideas, and what was down to the British. But I think one of the things that begins to shift even before Jenkins arrives is the linguistic balance. One of the other things that begins to change is the degree of informality and the degree of hierarchy. The commission structures were very hierarchical, very formal, and that does begin to break down in the 1970s, and I think the class of 73, so not just the Brits, but the Danes and the Irish, were partially responsible for that. But I do think there is an acceleration of this impact under Jenkins for two reasons. Firstly, because he does actually try and make some important changes. And while I think in many ways commission reform was one of the failures of his time in Brussels, there are some important and useful changes that he makes. I mentioned the proliferation of types of meetings. Another very noticeable change is the way in which briefs are prepared. I've had to look at the briefs that both Autoli, his predecessor, who was a Frenchman, and Jenkins took to all of the European Council meetings. And they are utterly different. Autoli took this, it looks a bit like my desk, to be honest, this kind of jumble of papers that seemingly had no order, etc. I'm sure he could find his way through them, but nobody else could. Jenkins, by contrast, turns up like a good British minister with a succession of neatly typed briefs organised under headings, with tables of contents and lots of tools to allow you to find your way around it. That was a clear imported British technique that was, in a sense, parachuted into Brussels. And although I had haven't seen the papers from the Torn and Delors era or as closely, my guess is that it survived after Jenkins' departure. So I think there was some impact, but I don't think he transformed it in the way that perhaps he hoped to do. And I think generally it was a slow uphill grind to change Brussels' administrative culture, although ultimately I think a lot did change in directions the British were quite comfortable with. And what will happen from now on is another story. Hussein, your questions. Was he an institution builder? I don't think he thought. I don't think he was somebody who liked to think in institutional terms. I think he saw himself as a policymaker. He saw himself as a key interlocutor and dialogue partner with his counterparts around the world. I think he saw himself as a political operative who could change the perception of the Commission, and that anticipates your second question. But I think that was, as I said earlier, one of the disappointments of his period in charge. I don't think institutions per se fascinated him, although he actually had quite acute judgment when he needed to make institutional decisions, and I think he does make a number of quite significant changes to the institution. Not revolutionary, but there are some important incremental changes that he makes to the way in which the Commission President operates that are enduring. He creates, for instance, what will become under Delors the Cellule de Prospective, but its origins lie in the Jenkins era, so this is a kind of mini in-house think tank which will think about some of the longer-term issues. He tries to break the pattern of very rigid meetings in Brussels by taking the commissioners out of Brussels and taking them to hotels in the Ardennes and trying to get a kind of brainstorming going. He tries to make the dialogue between different commissioners, which had been notoriously bad, a little bit better. It doesn't always work in the way that he intends, but I think he does try and make a difference. But I don't think that's instinctively his habitat. I think he did it quite well, but it was not where he saw his key impact. Relationship. Hold on. What was the second one? Was I can't read my own
his
handwriting.
Misconceptions.
Misconceptions.
What about Britain
and sort of learning on the job?
I think he turned up not. He by his own mission, he turned up not knowing very much about the role. He did benefit from 6 months prior, so he knew 6 months out that he was going to become Commission President, and being a hard-working man, he read himself into his role, he talked extensively, etc. But I still think he turned up not necessarily knowing very much how Brussels worked. He learned quickly, and the fact that his most productive period, in a sense, is the second half of his first year through until about year three, indicates that it didn't take him long to get up to speed. But I think there was a degree of misconception. So you've got to remember that he is a Commission President who has virtually no experience of Brussels. He had been a cabinet minister primarily during the era that predates British accession, so he hadn't gone to Brussels for council meetings or anything in the way that his successors would have done. But also, even when he becomes a cabinet minister again, briefly as Home Secretary under the Wilson government from 1974 onwards, Home Secretaries in those days didn't go to Brussels. They do nowadays, but there was no community policy on justice and home affairs and that kind of thing, so they didn't go. And so he's actually, in a sense, one of the sort of most un-Brusseled people, knowledgeable people around, despite his commitment to the European cause. And I think that does hold him back at first, but I think he masters that quite quickly. Relationship with Emile Noël, very good. They got on. He appreciated Noël as a fount of important wisdom. I have used the Noël papers, although not perhaps quite as much as the Jenkins stuff. But I did. But there are references to the Noël papers in the book, and I use them sort of intermittently. But no, the rapport seems to be genuinely good. Although, if you're trying to work out why he chooses not, in a sense, to engage in root and branch reform of the Commission, the fact that he chooses to ally himself not just with Noël but with the people he calls the three horsemen, who are the big three commissioners of Otterly, Gundelach the Dane, and Davignon the Belgian, who he regards as the cleverest men in the room with him, etc., but who also, by choosing to ally with them and Noël, he in a sense means vast amounts of the Commission can't be touched.
because he can't go and sort of be pally with Gundulac, who's the agricultural commissioner, and at the same time destroy the agricultural department, which is, or the director of DG6, which is the area where, so he in a sense limits his own options by the alliances he makes, including his alliance with Noel.
Then regional world level. Well, I don't think it's just Jenkins' dilemma. I think this is a globe. This is a dilemma that is felt very strongly by all of Europe's leaders at this time. And I think perhaps none more strongly than Helmut Schmidt. I've just been reading my colleague Christina Spohr's new biography on that, and she very much emphasises the way in which he saw himself as somebody who was the world economist who would solve the global crisis by actions through G7 at a global level. And so G7 is a very new institution which, like many new institutions, has great and unrealistic hopes attached to it at first. And I think there was a real perception that this could be the winning formula. Over time, it became clear that actually G7 has more limitations than it does strengths, and that it wasn't able to deliver on its initial promise. And it's only at that point of disillusionment that I think the attention shifts back to a European level. But so I don't think it's Jenkins' own dilemma. I think it's a much more widely shared one with the leadership class of that particular point in time, both in America but also I think in the key European countries who see G7 rather than Europe as the key formula.
Okay, I have a question down here. David Stevens, one at the back and then one down here. I'm trying to get them different geographical areas, so you can start.
Hi, I'm Will Mitchell. Why do you think after 6 years of a very high-profile British politician leading the European Commission, Britain still saw Europe as much as the other as they did before?
Well, of course, it's only 4 years rather than six years, but
Well, I think fundamentally Jenkins was to discover that if you isolate yourself in Brussels, and that would be the way that it would be described by the British political class, which may in itself be telling, you actually lose your principal pulpit to talk to the British people, etc. So he does try and cultivate a good rapport with the British press. He does spend disproportionately amount of time trying to get close to British journalists in Brussels or talking to newspaper editors, etc. And he was good at that kind of thing because that involved fine dining and nice wine and so on, rather than canteen level discussion with the hoi polloi. But so he schmoozed the press and tried to get close to them, but fundamentally his voice was always rather distant, and the tone of the debate about Britain and Europe was fundamentally shaped by what was coming out of the British government and to a certain extent the British opposition party, and was not influenced by the remote figure in Brussels, even if he was a former British heavyweight politician. And I think this is particularly so because, of course, this is also a period where he is, in a sense, fundamentally falling out of love with his party, political party. And so the way in which his views might have been amplified and magnified within a British context through the sort of echo chamber of the Labour Party, that is becoming increasingly unviable as he goes, as his presidency continues, and he doesn't vote in the 1979 election because he can't bring himself to vote for Thatcher, but at the same time he can't support Callaghan, and he's basically drifted away from Labour long before he comes back and forms the helps form the SDP.
Okay, you had a question right at the back and then a question down here at the side, which I've already allocated. So back, please, David. It's you.
David Stevenson. Did he think of himself as being our man in Europe? In other words, that he was there to represent British interests? Or did he think he was going there to make the institutions work and did in everybody's interest? Or were there situations where he thought there might be potential conflict between acting on behalf of British national interests and acting on behalf of the community interests? And if so, how did he resolve that? And a kind of related thing. I mean, nowadays one might ask how he saw his identity as being. Did he think of himself as being European first and British second, or Welsh or something,
citizen of the world? But
yeah, well, indeed, but I mean, he may not have thought in those terms, but perhaps if you'd asked him, what do you think he would have said?
Yeah. Can we have this question here as well? Then you've got to two peers, the man in the blue shirt.
Thank you very much for your very interesting talk. My name's Rick Bennett. I do remember quite a few of these events that you've talked about, and one of the things that struck me whenever Jenkins was being interviewed, either on the radio or the television, but he gave the impression of being an intensely shy man. And obviously that hampered his relationships not only within the Labour Party, but also when he reached the EU, and virtually everybody apart from the group that he took with him, the British group, were all strangers. And I just wondered if anything in the diaries, how honest was he about his shyness? And would you agree that he was a shy man?
Okay. Take those two, and then we'll...
Okay, yeah, sure. I think he did... I don't think he saw himself explicitly as the sort of the British envoy in Brussels. And it's interesting that when he first arrives in Brussels, one of the first things that happens is the UK permanent representative, so in effect de facto the British ambassador to the European community, gets in touch with Tickell in his private office and says, we used to have sort of fortnightly week meetings or so on with Christopher Soames and George Thompson, your predecessors. Can we continue this habit now that you're committed president? To which he writes back very firmly and says, no, doing this would be appropriate for me to have detailed discussions about this. And I think also in his preparatory period, it's quite clear he was talking to the British government, and he definitely sort of plays that down in both the way he talks about his preparations and in what he shows in public. So I don't think he wanted to see himself in that respect. I don't think he initially saw a contradiction between the two. I think what he felt he could do was that if he could get Europe working again, or if he could, if he could contribute to a revival and of the dynamism and sort of beneficial effects of European integration that had been enjoyed by the six founder members throughout the early years of their membership, and if he could contribute to restarting the integration process and getting it moving forward, that in itself would transform Britain's relations with Europe. I think he felt very much that the disaster or tragedy of British membership was that they had joined just at the moment when the party ended, just at the moment when the bubble burst, and that therefore it was crucially necessary for Europe to show what it could do for the British to change their minds. But if it started delivering, that would produce the outcomes, and that would produce the transformation of Britain's role and Britain's attitude towards Europe that he so desired to see. So I don't think he saw a contradiction. I think the moment where it becomes a bit more difficult is over the budgetary issue. There he clearly does feel that he has to act to a certain extent as a British advocate. He does so not, I think, out of patriotism, but again out of political calculation, because he realises that unless this budgetary issue is settled, and settled in a way that at least goes some direction towards the British demands, this is going to forever sour the relationship, and this is going to make the whole thing untenable. So I think he does take a rather British line there. But even then, he uses the fact that he, in a sense, has a foot in both camps, both to try and explain the British position to the French or to the Belgians or to the Danes or whatever, but also to explain to Mrs. Thatcher and to her entourage quite how rigid some of the limits were, and the inflexibility and sort of advise them on points which they should not press on, and give them suggestions as to where there might be room for compromise. So I think he does play quite a clever game there, but that is where the ambivalence is perhaps most apparent. In terms of his identity, I don't think he ever felt anything other than British, but at the same time, I don't think he'd ever had a problem seeing himself as European. So I don't think he saw himself fundamentally as either of those issues being a problem. And I think he would have believed very strongly that there should not be a contradiction between these two things. It was indeed the very perception that there was a contradiction between those two things that he'd spent most of his political career fighting against. And so I don't think that was a problem that he had. A shy man? Fundamentally, yes. But I think in some ways he's a very surprising shy man in that he clearly is immensely sociable and immensely gregarious. So his social life, and through to the Campbell biography we know, his sex life was pretty sort of busy. He spent his weekends going back to England to massive parties. Every time he was in the United States, he was hobnobbing with virtually the whole East Coast political elite. He was terribly well plugged into multiple social circles. So he was not a sort of a shy man who lurked in his bedroom. I think the shyness is there because I think he found it difficult to... He was one of these people, actually, it's a type that I think many in a university context will recognise well. I think he's somebody who has no real small talk. I think he's somebody who can relate to the clever and to the intelligent and to those he's interested in very well, and he was witty and he could be funny and he was very sharp and analytical and so on. But he could not for the life of him bring himself to have a conversation with somebody he found boring. And he showed that he found it boring, and that of course is the kiss of death. If you show somebody that you're bored with them, that's the end of your... And so I think that's his problem. I think that more than shyness.
Okay, now I've got lots and lots of questions. But the shyness has gone. Everybody wants to ask a question. Right, I'll take one here. What have we got? One in the middle, one over there. That at least I've got some sense of the balance of the room, at least. So you start, please.
James Ellison. Piers, Roy Jenkins was known as a progressive moderniser in British politics before going to Brussels. Would you say, in comparison with the other Brussels seniors that you've known, that he was a progressive moderniser there? And also, he was also known as a pro-European and a defender of the European project. Did his view of the European project change, having spent time in Brussels?
Okay, we'll take that one first, and then you in the middle.
Peter Hart, how, if at all, has his reputation and legacy been affected by Brexit?
I knew there'd be a Brexit question. Okay.
And then... middle, yeah.
Yes, Robert Wallace. And leading on from that, could we just ask you a bit more speculative now in two parts. Firstly, does Roger Jenkins actually make a difference? If you look back over 4 decades, would it have mattered who was there? Does he make a difference? And again, I'd also like to know, really speculatively, can you see the continuum, the linkages between 77 to 80? And Brexit or 2016.
We knew there'd be some questions about it.
We've staved
them off for half an hour, so done well.
Progressive modernizer. Yes, I think he saw himself, and it's surprising really, given the view that we now have or often have of monetary integration. I think he saw that as a vital modernising project within the European context. I think he was very struck by the way in which monetary fluctuations were rendering, in a sense, null and void most policy efforts by European countries during the 1970s to combat the economic crisis, and therefore strongly believed that if you could sort of deal with the monetary issue, if you could stop the gyrations of European currencies against one another, you could make automatically much more effective the policies that national governments were trying to carry out with respect to their economies. And so I think he saw that as a job-creating, job-protecting, sort of socially good policy, which is, of course, as I say, very different from the attitude towards the EMU that we currently have. But it's perhaps fantasy, but that nevertheless I think was very much his take on the issue. And if you look at the case that he makes for the EMU, it is very much linked to the idea that this will help what perhaps could be described as progressive modernism. Does his view of Europe change? Not fundamentally. I think he turns up as an enthusiastic pro-European, very committed to a British role within this, but with a relatively undogmatic attitude on the sort of institutional balance. He's not an ardent federalist. He doesn't believe the Commission should run everything. He's enthusiastic about the idea of an elected, directly elected European Parliament and would like to see them acquire some more powers. So that doesn't bother him, and in a sense he's quite supportive of the European Parliament. I think he finds some aspects of the role and of the job frustrating, but he doesn't react to those by saying, OK, let's redesign the system entirely. That's not his instinct, because in a sense what I was saying to Hussein as well, I don't think he instinctively sort of reaches for his institutional architectural design pad as soon as he encounters a problem. I think he's much more somebody who in a sense says, OK, the system is as it is, we can make a difference at the margins, but the key is having good ideas, persuasive policies, good rhetoric to defend those policies, and good behind-the-scenes deal-making, all of which he was good at. And that was the way he wanted to operate. So I don't think it has a big change. Effect of Brexit on his reputation. Well, I think it serves as a reminder both of what Britain has now, in a sense, lost, because the British will never again have access to top jobs within the European Community EU system. Arguably, they'd already lost that, but anyway, that's another issue. But also a reminder of how endemic and how long-standing the Britain and Europe problem is. Sort of, as you know, because you heard the Cumberland Lodge talk, I'm not somebody who feels that this was a marriage bound to end in the divorce courts from the very start, but I think the story of Jenkins' time in Brussels is an indication that it was a difficult and problematic marriage from the very outset, and Jenkins was somebody who in a sense in the end paid both in his domestic political career and in his presidency for some of those problems. So yes, I do think I don't know whether this changes his reputation. I think it does change a little bit the optic of the way in which you view this. It just becomes yet another piece of evidence of the long, slow, and ultimately sad tale of how we got to where we are now. Did it make a difference? I think it made a difference at a European level. I think his role on the MS, his role on enlargement, his role on even the British budgetary issue, his role in gaining a status position in the G7 made a difference to the job and helped build a platform on which later presidents, notably Delors, could build. I think a weak president, if you'd had Gaston Thorn for 8 years, so both in the late 70s and in the early 80s, that could very seriously have damaged the Commission's ability to be taken at all seriously as a policy interlocutor, and therefore would have meant that when somebody with Delors' abilities turned up, wouldn't have been given the room to put forward any of his ideas. So I think it does make a difference at the European level. Does it make a difference to the Britain and Europe story? There I'm much more doubtful, and I think he would have identified that as the great disappointment of his time period in Brussels.
I think I could take a couple more questions, and there were some people down here I think too as well. Yes, you were asking a question before, so and you, yes. Let's take this too.
Okay, Piers, thank you so much for your talk. I'm fascinated by the fractious relationship that he had, obviously, with Callaghan, and presumably with Thatcher too. So to what extent do you think that being a heavyweight politician does have real problems, though, when you come with these kinds of baggages to a post like the presidency of the European Commission?
And then I have one more question. Yes, you.
Yes. Hitoshi Suzuki, visiting fellow. I'd like to hear a little bit more about a sort of continuity or discontinuity between Christian Solms and Roy Jenkins, because from a Japanese sense of view, Solms was sort of exceptional in Brussels, that he was very sensitive against any hostile or discriminating tones against Japan. And your book briefly touches Japan and Jenkins' relations. Do you see a continuity there? And that stems to the second question. Do you see these two sort of British contribution at the European level as one of the origin of European Commission's global role? That's, I think, a sort of a question which integration historians are always tackling. I think the Germans would be counter-argued that it was the Germans who counter-argued any protectionist claims against Japan, but it seems to me that the British has a better stake, so to say, in terms of Commission's sort of more global viewed. Thank you.
Yes, heavyweight. I don't know whether the problem there was being a heavyweight. I think a cipher as a Commission President would simply... Well, I don't know. I've never looked at the dialogue between a cipher of a Commission President, and there have been one or two of them, and heavyweight politicians. But my impression is that you would simply end up with the sort of dialogue, or perhaps monologue, where the Commission would simply be, particularly by somebody like Thatcher, lectured about what it should be doing and would not be able to get a word in edgeways. Sort of Jenkins' strength was that he was a big enough personality and a heavyweight enough politician to get many a word in edgeways. There were a few moments when, particularly when Schmidt was talking or Thatcher was talking, where you had to kind of brace yourself and let the storm blow over. But nevertheless, he was somebody who could, in a sense, give as good as he'd got, and it was a fantastic debate, etc. So I don't think the problem was being heavyweight. I think the problem with both of them was being British. I think with Callaghan, the two people had, sort of, he had such a difficult relationship. They were always very correct with one another when they spoke directly. I think the nastiness comes out in the way in which they manoeuvre behind the scenes against one another, or at least Callaghan manoeuvres against Jenkins. I'm sure, had roles been reversed, Jenkins would have manoeuvred against Callaghan, but because Callaghan had more power. And so there is a nasty strain of vindictiveness over the G7 episode. There's no reason why the British should be so anti-Commission President being present, and I think had it not been Jenkins, they wouldn't have been so present. So there's a, so it adds a kind of personal edge to things, but I don't think it's really to do with him being a heavyweight. With Thatcher, it's a fascinating relationship because at first it's really quite amicable, would be putting it too strongly, but it's nevertheless quite a good friendly interaction. In the first few meetings, she comes over to Brussels as leader of the opposition still, and very much plays the role, which I think was fairly accurate for somebody who doesn't know very much about the system, and lets Jenkins, as the sort of the expert, tell her how it works and what the rules and do's and don'ts of Brussels life are, and he quite likes playing that role. When she first comes in, he's treated to a long plaidoyer about how she intends to be a tremendously pro-European leader and wants to differentiate herself from the anti-European policies of her predecessors, etc. And again, Jenkins is kind of lapping this stuff up. And then, so quickly, you suddenly get the appearance of the budgetary role and the coming to the surface of a whole series of resentments, particularly vis-à-vis Giscard and Schmidt, which Jenkins is, in a sense, powerless to resist. There's this extraordinary meeting where she spends 25 minutes just denouncing France and Europe at length, and Jenkins is sort of there, kind of sheltering from this onslaught. And every now and again, does look, the French are actually net contributors. Hurricane Thatcher blows on. So, and that really wasn't him. That was just simply, he was simply being caught in the tailwind of this tremendous animosity that she built up, both over the budgetary issue and, I think, with a little bit of justification about the way she was treated. I don't actually think Giscard treated her very generously when she first arrived. Schmidt and Giscard were too close to one another, so it was always going to be difficult to be a third person in that. But Giscard actually makes a series of really rather petty, sort of doesn't sit her next to him, for instance, when she has her first European Council meeting. Little things, but it's a kind of way that is not very generous and probably contributes to her resentment. How much of this is sort of sexism or whatever, I don't want to speculate, but she wasn't treated well, and that resentment builds up enormously quickly.
Soames Jenkins continuity. Well, Soames is a remarkable European commissioner, you're right, and in many ways Jenkins does continue quite a lot of that tradition, that internationalist outlook. He, of course, holds a different position. He's commission president as opposed to external relations commissioner, but he does share a similar view that the commission ought to, that the European community needs to be an outward looking trading partner with good relations with all of its major interlocutors. And one of the things I try and do in the book is show how much energy and time he throws into the task of travelling the world and talking to his counterparts, both in major economies like the Japanese, but also emerging economies in Africa and India and elsewhere. So I think he there is a continuity there. I think on Japan, he hoped to play on his relationship, which was pre-existing with Fukuda, because they had both been finance ministers at the same time. I think he sincerely hopes to make this a stronger relationship. In the end, I think relatively little changes during that period, largely because there isn't really the kind of meat of the relationship between the Commission and the United States. Do the British and does Jenkins contribute to Commissioner of the global role? Yes, I think so. I think that is something he does well. He's not helped by the fact that he has to appoint a German external relations commissioner, Haferkamp, who he doesn't think very highly of, to the external relations role, because he doesn't want to give this to Autoli, and they're the senior two figures, so he's got to give the external relations job to it. And Haferkamp does make a little bit of a mess of certain things, helps trigger, for instance, the expenses scandal by spending an outrageous amount of money entertaining his mistress in Beijing, and various other things. So there is a little bit of a fiasco on his watch, but that's not really of his own making. And I think his own international diplomacy is, on the whole, pretty good. He does that with pleasure and with energy and with a degree of success. And I am very struck by how, for instance, when he visits China, he's very good at sitting down with the Chinese leadership and discussing global politics at a really rather sort of serious level, in a way that I don't think Autoli could have done, Thorne certainly couldn't, and I suspect even Delors would have struggled at. So I think that isn't it a demonstration of Jenkins at his best.
Okay, I think it's now for me to say a few words. If you've liked the lecture, you will love the book. And the book is on sale just outside this room, and for a small consideration, Piers will even sign it. But even more importantly, it's there at a bargain 30% off if you either buy the book or commit yourself to it.
Even more if you pay in another currency.
That's right. It's even cheaper in euros and even cheaper than that in dollars. We can't offer the fine wines of Jenkins, but there is a reception outside the room here with some wine and nibbles. You're very welcome to come to that as well. Finally, thank you very much for coming. Thank you for your questions, but thanks above all for Piers, not only for the lecture, but for handling those questions so enormously skillfully. So thank you very much, Piers.